This is the Final Round Podcast, coming to you live from the FingerLakes1.com studios in downtown Seneca Falls, New York. And now your host, Chris Marquardt.
Good afternoon, good evening, welcome to episode number 14 of the Final Round Podcast. Excited to be coming to you from the all-new FingerLakes1.com studios in the North Park building here at Academy Square. It's the new home of Finger Lakes One on Cuga Street here in Seneca Falls. We've relocated, and this is the first time that Final Round has been able to come to everybody from the new facility. Still got a little bit of work to do in terms of getting some of the furniture put in place. Right now we're reduced just to director's chairs, and Jason Oldfield, unfortunately, is flying without that comfy chair that he's so accustomed to. I know Jason was anxious to make his way up here and hang out with us. Fun show on deck tonight. We're going to be talking with Sal Biondo with Biondo Racing Products and talking a little bit about, he's got such a deep family history in drag racing as a whole. We'll touch a little bit on Empire Dragway and their continued efforts to get 2017 started. And then also we'll hit on a little bit of the, it's not necessarily news, but unfortunately it's one of those things that sort of comes to the forefront of your memory as we get closer to the start of the full-blown drag racing season over there at Spencer Speedway. We'll hit on some of that stuff towards the backside of it, but first, welcoming again Jason, making the trip up. Good to see you. What do you think of the new place?
Oh, it's nice. I mean, it seems like it's been a million years since I've been up here, and we've been doing a podcast, so yeah, it's nice to get back into it here. Yeah.
Jason's toured the countryside. I had some business to do in Minnesota, however, didn't get any drag racing in while you were up there.
Did not. Went down to North Carolina, didn't get any drag racing in down there either, even though I'm sure there was something going on down there while I was down there. But yeah, it's like I said, it seems like it's been a long time. But yeah, new studios are nice. I'm sure it's going to work out really great for us. And yeah, looking forward to getting back in the swing of things now that really racing season is really started, I guess I'll say. I mean, there's a couple of big races this weekend. I know, you know, locally we got Empire's got the 470 guys running this weekend. I know Lancaster's, they got a 495 show going this weekend. Next weekend is Memorial Day, right?
So
next
already.
already, exactly. So yeah, it's a huge, it's going to be a huge weekend next weekend. So yeah, we're racing.
Yep. And want to welcome Sal Biondo onto the show. Sal, man, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You bet. So Jason had worked on putting this conversation together a little bit, and there's such a deep history with your family and drag racing. I was wondering first if you'd just kind of walk us through a little bit about how you got into the sport as a whole.
Well, Dad, growing up in New York, probably did a little street racing. We don't have to get into that. We all know that it's safe. Back in the 50s, though, it was probably a big deal. But he got into racing that way, then brought it out to the drags and did some heads-up stuff with his 58 Bonneville and, you know, slowly became more into it. And then he learned about this, dial-in thing and this bracket racing thing and this head start. And, wow, look at this. It was basically like an instant green thing. But he was always a big thinker. He got right into it and figured out if the guy was leaving like 2/10 before him, he'd figure out the exact spot where he was able to leave on the other guy's green. So by the time he hit the gas, he'd be able to have almost a perfect light. And he figured out a lot of things. He was always thinking. And that's kind of the whole way this started, just by my father being a thinker. You know, he wasn't the type of guy who was just going up there to race. He was thinking about rollout and deep staging and reaction time and things like that. He was way ahead of his time, way ahead.
Yeah, I have to say, I mean, really, Sal, that is, you talk about, you know, even going back to, you know, the 60s and 70s, you know, those types of things weren't things that most racers, drag racers, had any idea about or were thinking about at that point in time. So there's no doubt that, yeah, he was way, way ahead of the curve.
Yeah, I mean, even the days of when Supergas first started, he'd be the only guy deep stage, and he would race against these small block, high revving Chevys, and he ran, you know, my late Uncle Butch DiLorenzo's 68 Firebird, which was just a 455 Firebird, weighed a ton. It was a tank. But him deep stage, and he can beat the small block Lenko Vegas and the Monzas and all these guys leaving at crazy RPMs. They couldn't figure out how and why my father would be able to get to the finish line first and run slower
Right, right.
You know, so in the big car, that was probably foot braking, leaving at 3,800 or so, if possible. But him being the thinking man was the whole start of all of this. Never would we have imagined what it would have become and how we would have began racing. But being there all the time, just it was something Peter and I were going to do no matter what.
Right, right. Now, I guess, I mean, there's so many questions I have kind of right off the bat. I mean, I've known your dad, Sam, for quite a while, though I will say that, you know, I've really gotten to know your dad, I guess we'll call it, you know, kind of more towards the tail end of his racing career.
Mm-hmm.
You know, did he start like most do, you know, mm-hmm. racing in stock and junior stock and stuff like that?
No, he absolutely just started. Oh, you mean the heads up stuff, I guess it was called junior stock, but there was very little of that. He got involved mostly in the bracket race thing in the early 70s. Very, very intrigued by the whole bracket racing idea.
Okay.
Deep staging thing. There was no reaction time. So he was basically at the track, and I mean, I think I was 6 years old and can remember going to the track and him red lighting in a time run was a good thing because he knew he can just back up a little bit in the beams and then he'd be good the rest of the weekend. So red lighting was a goal, and you know, here I am, 6, maybe 8 years old, thinking, yeah, if Dad red lights, then he's going to have a good day here. So he was always interested in how to make himself better, and tricks he could get, and getting the most he could out of his car and get wins, you know.
Yeah, and I have to say, I didn't realize that your dad raced Super Gas. So is he one of the, you know, let's call it early Super Gas, you know, Pro Gas at the time, pioneers in the late 70s, early 80s?
I can't say a pioneer. All I can say is he's a bracket racer and saw, once again, the opportunity. I can race this car in deep stage and hit this 410 tree. I can hit it. I know I can.
Yeah.
I know we can deep stage and hit this tree. And so he wasn't really into the NHRA and the traveling. I mean,
yeah.
he did like it a little bit, but he liked bracket racing. He liked going away for the weekend with us also, you know, Peter and I. And, you know, those are the best memories we have of bracket racing. But as far as Super Gas, no, he just he got into it in the beginning. It was called Pro Gas at the time. It was
right.
Just a fun thing. They had it a couple times at English Town on a Wednesday night. And he won it a few times, but never really hit the circuit with it. Wasn't interested in hitting the circuit, I guess, you know, with young children. You know, it was tough for him to travel.
Yeah, now when they started, I know when we started Pro Gas at Lancaster in the, oh, I'm going to call it 80, 81, somewhere in there. At that point in time, it was still a true bracket class where you were dialing your number on the window. So it was a handicap pro tree head start. Was that how it started down in Englishtown too?
No, it was, if I remember correctly, it was 990 and it was a pro tree.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
And so was Englishtown, is that what you guys would really consider to be your home track? Is that the track you guys grew up at?
Absolutely. I was just discussing this with my daughter, and she plays soccer, and my son plays hockey and lacrosse, and they're all over the place. And they were like, well, Dad, what did you do when in high school? I said, what did I do? I rushed to make the 210 train to get home in time to make Wednesday night shows, Friday night shows, and be away for the weekend.
Wow.
We didn't have any sports applications because Peter and I just about, when Peter played some sports, but minimally. But yeah, we did a ton of bracket racing, and it was always Englishtown, Wednesdays, Fridays somewhere else, Saturday at ACCO, sleep over to Sunday at Englishtown. It was constant Englishtown just about. It was actually National Speedway before it closed. That was in Long Island.
Right, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But that was before I was able to drive. I was too young. And then it closed, and then Englishtown became the home track.
So now, I know you're the elder brother, so how much older are you than Peter?
2 years.
Okay, so, all right, don't take this the wrong way. I thought you were a little bit older than that.
That's okay. That's all right.
So, yeah, so when, you know, growing up, I mean, you and I basically did the exact same thing, right? I mean, I didn't play any sports in high school. I mean, I was interested basically in racing, and, you know, during the week I was at the garage with my dad working on the race car the whole time. So, you know, when we were kids growing up, you know, there were no junior dragsters and stuff like that. So we were going out to the track with our dads, essentially. You know, how did you get started racing yourself? Was it, you know, Street ET?
We had a little show at Englishtown they did once a year, which was with big wheels, and it was kind of fun. It was a pro tree, so nobody would red light, and the kids wouldn't red light. The parents would hold them back. But Peter and I, you know, we were quick. You know, we knew all about stage and go
right.
and pro tree, and
right.
it was just heads up. Whoever gets there first, I think it was 60 feet or 100 feet maybe,
yep.
you know. But so we just went to the track, and I don't even know if it was ever discussed. We just kept going until we were old enough to do it ourselves. I think all the years of going, we had a ball, we loved it, and it was just, we were always there. But what really, I think what really got the hook in my mouth was West Hampton, Long Island, had a drag strip, and they allowed passengers. They just, you know, and I was, I wanted to go down the track with someone, and I was asking my father, and we found guys, Nick Nicholas. I mean, he ran pro stock, but back then he had like a 68 Camaro that went, I think, 970, and back then, in 1975, that was tremendously fast. And my father said, no way, you're not getting in that car. So we found a friend of his who just recently passed away, George Roach. He had a Sugar Bear Nova, and that was the name of it. It said Sugar Bear. It was like a 71 Nova. And I sat in the passenger seat, could barely see over the dashboard, and he just told me to hold on. And, you know, my father told me, be quiet when he hits the tree and hold on. But he'd hit the tree, and it was probably a low 13-second Nova, and he was catching people and on and off the throttle, and we just, that was it. I couldn't wait to do this. all the races I've been to, all the racing I've seen, when I was in that passenger seat that day, I remember getting out of the car, I said, I cannot wait to do this myself. So being a passenger like that was a lot of fun.
Well,
it really is.
Yeah, I have to say that when I was a kid, so I'm going to probably call it 7-8 years old. So at the time, my dad was running modified, and the Corvette probably ran, I'm going to guess, 630s or 640s in the eighth mile at the time. And we knew the management pretty well at Lancaster. And my dad said to them, hey, I want to take my boy for a ride. So my dad got in, strapped himself in, put his helmet and fire jacket on. I borrowed someone's fire jacket. We borrowed a couple of fire jackets. One I sat on, the other one I put on. I had a helmet and I hung onto the roll bar. And my dad took that, you know, small block 5-speed Corvette and blasted down the track. I have to say, I was terrified, absolutely terrified at the time. And, you know, I look back now and I'm like, I'm really glad that I have the story and the memory to tell.
Yes.
At the same point in time, that was really dumb, and I would never do that with my kids. But it was pretty incredible. I remember getting at the end of the track and my dad asking me, yeah, so, you know, did you see anything? It's like, I didn't see anything. My eyes were as big as saucers, and I was basically just looking straight ahead and couldn't wait for it to be over, I guess. So, yeah, I mean, similar experience to you, I guess.
Yes, exactly. And I've taken my son down in a slower car, you know, a high 11-second car with
yep.
a passenger seat
with
the harness in it, helmets, fire
right.
jacket, everything. And we've actually done a little bracket racing like that, too. And he's not comfortable at all. He says that I never look straight. I don't understand. Never look straight. Well, if I'm going 11-80 and they're going low 10s, guess what? You know,
right.
we got to find him. We got to see where he's at. But yeah, we did a little bit of that, and yeah, you know, I think of the safety of it, and I've been running that car for 15 years, and it's almost like a street car. But yeah, it is a risk. But he absolutely loved it, and shortly thereafter, we got right into juniors, and of course, you know, like, we didn't have juniors when we were kids, but the kids absolutely love it, and some of those kids, they get so good. I can't say my kids are going to be phenomenal racers. They're kind of part-time since I've traveled so long and did so much in NHRA and been everywhere. I didn't really want them to be racing like I was Fridays, Saturdays, Sundays, Wednesdays, you know. So they got involved in sports a lot. So we don't sign up for the points with them. We just have a good time. We go when we can. I'm fortunate enough to race at New Media Dragway in Pennsylvania where they let me keep my rig. You sign up for the points. They let everybody keep their stuff there.
Oh,
and when you're 2.5 hours from New York to PA and you go somewhere, nothing's tied down, you drop the door and you go, there's no back and forth, no tolls with the motorhome and the trailer. It's, you know, a lot less when you're just hopping in a car and going, and it really makes it fun. And we did have a ball for the past couple of years, and we're ready to start up soon. School's coming to a close, so we'll be back at it again.
So I got a couple of questions just to revisit a couple of the topics that we hit on earlier. First off, the 58 Bonneville. Why the Bonneville versus something else? What was the significance of the Bonneville? Did that have some sort of performance edge over its other GM counterparts?
You know what? It was way before I was born. I'm just stating that car because I remember pictures of that and him displaying his trophies with his friends in Brooklyn and all the trophies that they had won back then. But I guess it did have some performance advantage at the time against the similar models.
Right, and then as for you and Jason, you could jump on this too. It might be a little bit. Maybe a little bit different for you given location. When you say that you were bucking out of school and you weren't playing sports, was that an anomaly, or were there other racing fans given where you lived that were doing the same thing, and you were running into classmates and some of your school peers at the racetrack that were into the same thing?
Absolutely not. Nobody in my school was doing this. Everybody was into sports and most kids were doing their own thing, but there wasn't anyone in this neighborhood. You know, living right outside the city, first of all, you don't have a location, a garage, a driveway. You can't put a lot of your stuff and bring it home. A lot of our stuff stayed in a rented spot in New Jersey. So, Jason says, he remembers working on his car, We didn't do much working on anything because we couldn't, and my father wasn't very mechanically inclined, which, you know, a lot of people may not know that, and hey, we get that from him too, not being around and not working on stuff. You don't learn how to do a lot of this. So we've just been drivers, but the neighborhood itself, being right outside New York City, there weren't a lot of people who had really heavy-duty, bracket cars.
Right.
But this particular neighborhood of Maspeth and Middle Villages area where I live, you had my Uncle Butch DiLorenzo, and you had you had dozens of guys who came from the neighborhood. But the kids who were my age weren't going to the track. They really weren't. It wasn't something you did. It was probably an hour and a half away. And kids my age weren't really doing that at all, even when Maple Grove had a high school challenge, and everybody from the high schools all went and attended. I mean, it was always my brother and I were the only ones from our high school that were there, because it's far away, and kids weren't into it. It was just location, basically. I'm sure the kids who lived near English Town were racing a lot younger and had peers and classmates and people they knew from the neighborhood all went to the track together. But in our case, living near the city, It was really us. I mean, it was me just going because I wanted to go, and catching that 210 train meant I was making the race.
I was a lot closer to the drag strip than you were. I mean, Lancaster was only 30 minutes from my house, but it was the same thing, in where I grew up too. I mean, I was the only one essentially in that I grew up with that really did anything with that. Now we happen to have a guy across the street, John McGowan, a real good friend of mine. When he got to be old enough, he started racing. His dad raced, but basically by the time I was a kid, his dad had stopped racing. So there was really nobody else around doing that. And it was funny because it wasn't until I got to high school and people started being driving age and taking an interest in cars. That's when it was like all of a sudden I started seeing some of these people and was like, mm-hmm. Yeah, where have you guys been for the last 10 years, right? It's like I've been working on cars for the last 10 years and you were nowhere to be found. But now that you have a 74 Monte or whatever it is, now you're interested in cars. But yeah, I mean, it was the same. I mean, there was nobody, unless you had a family member or a good friend that was doing it, there was nobody around that was doing anything like this.
And a lot of kids had hot rods and stuff, and then you would bring them to the track, and they wouldn't understand, what are we doing here? We're not just going to the finish line?
Right.
Well, no, not really. And, and I would show them my so-called race car was a 77 Buick Wagon, and, well, you race that? That's not cool. who could understand consistency? And they didn't understand. I mean, I did have in college a group that did come to the track, but it turned them off a little bit too. And I had a Grand National, and they had these big Buick Grand National showdowns. We would go to the race, and we would have a ball, and everybody would really have fun. And I won a few of them, but it was bracket style, and it wasn't really even fair. A lot of these guys just bringing their cars, even friends of mine, they didn't even know what a bracket race was, and here we are, there's 300 of us running in a category, together. So those guys there, they loved to come to the track. They had their Grand National, but they weren't interested in the bracket side of it because they just wanted to go fast.
The wagon, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that was a Malibu wagon?
That was a 77 Buick Estate wagon.
Well, the big
one? It was a big wagon.
It was cream colored. It was wood grain on the side and the best race car you can have. Visibility, it was a big block 455 with dual exhaust that didn't even get into third gear. Didn't even, I barely knew it was being raced. I think it, when I would lift after the finish line, it would shift into third because it would cross at like 3,800.
Yeah, I mean, it had
that's so
and it's
cool.
A dead hook every time.
273 gears in it or something like that, right?
Yeah, with white wall tires. Yeah, it went about 1570s. And, you know, visibility, we ran, Peter and I ran Street Eliminator, which back then, I think it was a little better for the beginner bracket race. A guy comes in, you know, now it's like it's 12 flat and up for somebody's, and even Pro ET being 9 flat and up, I think it's tougher for these guys to get into it. But back then, Street Eliminator, you'd race, it'd be 14 flat and up. And for me, it was great. I was 1570s in this wagon that would never spin, and there was a lot of guys with Mustangs and Corvettes that didn't want to run heavy ET because that was 1200 to 1399, and that intimidated them. So they would run Street ET and dial 1400. So yep. For me, that was the easiest run of the day, you know, because we all knew he was going 1360, but he thought, you know, he was just going to get out and pedal you, you know. But they caught on, though. They caught on, some of these guys. But that was fun. Street Eliminator being 14 flat and up was a lot of fun. Peter and I did that for a lot of years in that big wagon.
So I'm curious, what happened to that car? You know, my first car was a 78 Malibu that I bought that had a blown V6 in it. And my dad helped me build a 350 for it. And, you know, at some point in time, I got to the point where I had to sell that car, and I sold it, I think, for $800. And, you know, I certainly wish I'd never sold it. So what happened to the estate wagon?
Well, my sister ran it for a while after Peter and I progressed to some faster cars, and so my sister ran it, and we wound up selling it to a local guy at Englishtown, and I don't remember his name, but I know that the floor was falling out of it. It was really in bad shape, and it started even to run bad. I mean, after 15 years or so of racing with that thing, 12, I'm not even sure, but it had to have 5,000 runs on it, but I don't even know where it ended up. I wish we could have even tried to keep it, but where do you store something big like that? But it was definitely a classic. It was a great bracket car, but I don't know where it is to this day. It's probably in a junkyard or crushed or in a cube, you know. So
I say we'll go after the show. Chris and I usually go out and have an adult beverage. We'll go. You know, cheers to the Buick Estate wagon and its memory. So, now moving on from that. Now, when did you guys start, you know, kind of getting more involved in, I guess I would call it the more professional racing, if you will. You know, getting super stock and comp eliminator modified. I'm assuming by the time you started racing, modified was gone, right?
We lost him. I gotta get his number.
Oh no, we lost Sal.
He gave us a bad phone there.
Oh, we got to get him back here. That's
hang on. You texting that to me? You gonna text me that phone number?
I will text it to you.
Probably the best way to do it instead of reading his phone number over the air.
Yes, we won't do that. So, Sal, if you're listening, we will be back with you in a second. Yeah, I'll go ahead and text this over to you, Chris, so you can get that back. We get Sal back on the phone. Because, yeah, I got to definitely want to hear more about how he got involved in basically moving forward in super stock. And I also want to touch base with him, too, on how the Hatari name came to be on his dad's car.
There we go. You got us back, Sal?
Yes, I'm back.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
So we had some... we, were,
You were talking about after the show, something about the wagon being in a cube.
Yeah, well, I said Chris and I, we usually go have an adult beverage after the show, so we're going to go cheers to the estate wagon after the show.
Yeah.
But, you know, I started to then ask you when you got cut off, you know, how did you get involved in, I guess we'll call it the more, you know, professional classes, super stock, you know, being the age that you are, you're basically the same age as me, you know, modified was gone, so comp eliminator was then. So, I mean, I know you've run comp, you've run super stock. How did you start, I guess, getting involved in that?
My father was friends with Phil Monteith for a long time. They raced together, and he had a super stock. He was a big-time class racer and a big-time an HRA supporter. You know, he traveled the circuit. So he was traveling all the time, Philip, in between bracket racing, and they remained close. He even owned one of my father's race cars and built a motor for that. So my father got involved very little bit with the NHRA. He went to a couple races. One of his claims to fame is he went to Atlanta, and when Bobby Warren was world champ, and I don't even remember what year it was, but he beat Bobby Warren first round but got thrown out because he had the wrong helmet with him because Jim Harrington needed his helmet to run around and forgot to swap. So long story short, he got tossed after first round after beating Bobby Warren and going to Atlanta, all the way down to Atlanta to race, and thrown out after first round. So he kind of didn't want to travel anymore after that, although he did a little bit, just a little. But how did I get involved? I started to drive Phillip's car, Philip Monteith, that is, and we raced, you know, it was a foot-breaking, it was an old fiber, like a 74 Trans Am, and it was kind of tough battling with, you know, the Jeff Taylor and Charlie Taylor and these trans brake modified Achievers looking over our shoulder, and it was kind of tough, but we held our own, and I got my first national event win in that car. And so Philip was still racing, and Philip had a friend, John Gunn, who had an Oldsmobile. He's since passed away, but he had an Oldsmobile Sierra, and we were having a lot of trouble with Phil's car at one race, and we were running around in between races, and Phil kind of agreed that John wanted me to drive the Sierra. I said, all right, let me try to get in this Sierra and see what happens. And we just really hit it off, the Sierra and I, and Gunn. And I started running this Sierra all over the place. We traveled and won a lot of national events, came close to winning a championship, real close, number 2, 3, 4, traveling the country and, you know, lived the dream doing that. And after a bunch of years of racing the Super Soccer and bracket racing in between, I was approached by Vinnie Barone to run comp, which was for me just something unheard of. Well, what am I going to do? Well, how does this class work? And indexes, it took me a little while to get used to it, but it was kind of exciting. I wasn't much for a speed demon and never was, so hopping into a car, you know, I was going 1060s and bracket racing my dragster at 890, but hopping into a small block tube car and going 8-0s right off the bat was pretty scary for me, right? You know, especially, you know, people say, hey, the speed is the speed, but those cars, small tire, high RPM, you know, leaving at 7,000, they shift at 9, they're crossing almost 10 for a bracket race. That to me was just abuse and scary. You know, that was scary, you know, to be that. But that's how I kind of got started to super stock, the comp, and through the years, been lucky enough, some guys stopped racing, and I jumped on board with other guys, and we did this for a long time. I had a lot of fun traveling, won some national events, got a championship out of it, and met great people along the way. But it was just time to slow down a little bit. But that's kind of how I got into it. I got into it with Phil Monteith, definitely got my start with him, and Peter's still driving for him to this day.
Right.
And I noticed my father hops in the car every now and then too. Like, he'll be running English Town in a few weeks.
Oh, he will.
He's going to be 80 this year. He's still at it.
That's crazy.
Wow, that is unbelievable. I know that you know, we saw Chris and I, we were looking on the Biondo Racing Products Facebook page, and I found a picture. I think it was a Camaro, and it was a Firebird, but it's, you know, black. I'm going to call it a black 69 Camaro that said Hatari on the side. Now, was that Phil's car?
Yes, that's an original Ram Air 4 Firebird, and yes, that's the one my father had forever, and that was Phil's, yes. And we still have it. We still race it. It's up in New Media. We still bracket race with it.
Oh, no kidding. I didn't know that.
It's a great car. We just had a lot of it redone, and you know, my son will probably end up in that car. And, you know, here's a car that's, you know, I was born in 68, so here's a 69 Firebird that's been around much longer than he's even been alive. So
right. It's
pretty funny to think that he'll probably end up in that car.
Right.
That's
right.
Cool.
Yeah, that's very cool. So the Hatari name, is that Phil's? Is that Phil's
yes.
name then? So that's what
that
Phil
is, that is Phil. It's Hatari. And, you know, all the rumors, I guess, they announce when Peter's at events that it's danger in Swahili. I guess it means that. But I really did remember Philip calling it Hatari because Hatari was the Indian chief and leader of the tribe called the Pontiacs. So if I got that right, I think that's what it is. That's what it's all about.
Okay. Yeah, I was curious. I mean, yeah, because Chris and I talked about that a little bit, and I was like, I don't know what the significance of that is.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think that the NHRA announces, and Lewis Bloom and Alan Reinhardt have fun with it. It means, you know, danger in Swahili, and I think Alan Reinhardt has been famed to say it means you lose. So, it's funny, yes. But it originated from Phil, and pretty much, I guess, everything really came from Phil, the cause and the experience, the super stock ride, everything.
Oh, that's very, very cool. So now, how old is your son now?
My son just turned 18, so we're looking at colleges and going crazy, but he'll be racing again this year because he only turned 18, and it was in February, so he can race this year. He was 17 at the turn of the year.
Right.
So he'll get to more with juniors, that is. I mean, he can race a big car, too, but, you know, I almost took the junior away in a couple of years ago because you don't have to be, you can be 16 in
sure.
Pennsylvania and race.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of the parents talked me out of it. They said, you're only able to do this once. Stick with the juniors as long as you can and then move on. But not racing as much as I did when I was his age. My son, you know, we're breaking him in a little slower. Like, we have a little C300 Mercedes, and he was racing that last year, 1570s, 1580s, and he's been having a ball with that. So he's getting his feet wet like that, but hopefully this year we'll get out more. But once he goes, he's going away to college, so I don't even know what's going to happen after that. But
right. So
he's definitely the age to get moving into something faster.
So how?
Hit on something quick on Hatari.
Yeah.
Hatari. Danger in Swahili, and in 1962 there was an action adventure movie that was released starring John Wayne titled Hatari.
That's it. Yep.
Oh, no kidding. the power of
yes.
The power of Google, right?
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
So how far is the needle stuck in your son's arm? Is this where he bugs you every weekend once the weather gets nice to go to the races?
Well, he's on high school teams. Hockey's finished, and now he's in lacrosse. So he's pretty serious. The coach is serious. They want to win it. He's a senior. They're going into their semifinal round match tomorrow night, and we don't even really consider racing until that's over. And it seems like it's every year they get pretty far. So it'll be. Then he'll have his prom and he'll be graduating. So I'm imagining the end of May or June we start. But does he want to go every week? It seems like it's a little tougher to get him to stop, but once he starts, it's like that's it. Then he wants to go. Are we going this weekend? Are we going? Are we going? Are we going? And that's cool. That's cool. I really, it's fun, and that was the whole reason I kind of dropped off the circuit for a couple of years. I did it for a long time, probably since 1987 or 88. I was on the NHRA circuit, and it was probably 2014 when I stopped. I mean, I still do a little bit of racing, but
right.
I'm off the points. I'm not traveling. I'm not chasing points. We're doing this. I mean, I got a good friend, Dan Fletcher, everybody knows. We had a long talk about being stuck in the rain in Chicago for 3 or 4 days and missing everything at home, and he kind of, I'll exaggerate this a little bit, but he basically took me by the neck and said, you know, you don't have to do this. And I went to bed that night and really, really thought about it. And I said, you know what? He's right. So I put my notice in and raced a couple more years of Barone, but then we stopped. But, what I'm getting to here is, I remember growing up and having the best memories of my life, despite winning national events and having fun and traveling, even winning a championship, divisional championship, and Peter doing spectacular and winning all the big bracket races, my best memories are bracket racing with my father when I was, you know, 10, 11, 12, all those runs we did, weekends we stayed away, and I wanted to give my kids that. I wanted to give that to them. We have our motorhome up there, New Media Dragway. The trailer's there. The cars are there. Even though my daughter doesn't race much, she has a car. And whenever, it's always there for her. She plays a lot of soccer, so she doesn't get to race much. But do they want to do it? Yeah, they want to do it, and they're into it. But their priorities definitely are with the sports, and I'm happy about that. I'm happy. I like for them to do that because I never did any of that. Not that I regret it. I just want to. I want to see them do some other stuff too because we can always race.
I'm with you, Sal. You know, I've done the same thing, right? It's like my dad never really traveled all that much. I mean, he used to go to the WCS meet that was up at the time it was Cayuga, now Toronto Motorsports Park. But that's about as far as he traveled, other than going to Empire for, you know, bracket racing out there. And you know, after my dad passed away, it's like, you know, I started traveling the Northeast and going all over and having some fun. And you know, I was fortunate enough to win you know, points meet down at Maple Grove. But yeah, if you told me, you know, think back to, you know, your best memory out at the track. My best memory out at the track was when I was a kid and I was out at the track with my dad and we were, you know, racing at Lancaster on Friday night. It wasn't standing in the winner's circle at Maple Grove or doing anything like that. It was spending time with my dad. So, and I get it. And, you know, now I'm just like yourself that I still enjoy racing. And when I go out there, you know, I'm trying to win just like everybody else is. But I don't want to join the points, basically, because I don't want to be tied to having to go out to the racetrack every weekend, because there's weekends that I like sitting on my deck enjoying the summertime and spending time with my kids.
Exactly. We kind of lose, you know, the fuel to go. Like, we lose it a little bit because when we do have a pool, yeah, it gets nice and you want to stay home. But when everybody wants to go and it's my wife and I and the two kids and we take the dog and we go make a weekend out of it, it's a lot of fun. It really is. And not having to go, you don't have to go.
Right.
Because you're not in the points. You don't have to go. And that was, like, my biggest thing in with racing is I don't have to go now. I love to go. When I go, I have a lot more fun. Racing for people, I mean, with Vinny Barone, yeah, it was great. We traveled. I really did have a good time and appreciated the efforts of the team and him. But I do have to tell you, I did dread the January facts. And here's where we're going. And they'd be circled. And I'd be like, wow, there's a lot of circles on that page. You know, he'd basically just rip the page out of the National Dragster and of the points races and the national events and have them circled. And I'd be, you know, and I knew it, you know, having kids and missing a lot of things, being away a lot was really tough. So I'm at a different point of our life right now. We go when we want, and it's much different, and it's fun. It really is.
Are any of those tracks still running two nights a week?
Which ones?
You alluded to...
Englishtown?
Englishtown, yeah. Englishtown, you said, was doing two nights a week, and I thought you said there was one other one when you were a kid that you would make a couple nights a week. Are they still running twice a week?
Englishtown will run Wednesdays. They have some races on Wednesdays. They run... I'm not sure if they're still doing it, but they still... They do... So Friday's usually street nights. They used to have those where kids would just come out and race for fun. But with my father, we did a lot of... They were doing bracket races on Wednesday nights. They were doing a small bracket race on a Friday night. Then they'd have the weekend program, too, which was normally Sunday. So it was like Wednesday, Friday, Sunday at Englishtown. But we would do either Island Dragway or ATCO and then Englishtown for the whole weekend.
Where was ATCO?
Are they still doing it? Yeah, I'm pretty sure they're still doing it. Where's ATCO?
ATCO's in New Jersey. I mean, yeah,
yes, ATCO, Southern Jersey, yes.
Yeah, and they're still open. I mean, that's, you know, the big tracks in Jersey are ATCO and Englishtown. Now with the Englishtown, they have, and I don't know Englishtown all that well, but they have an eighth mile, a separate eighth mile track there, right?
They use that for junior dragsters and their trophy cars and the slower cars. So it runs the program a little smoother because they have two tracks to run on. And, you know, yeah, like I said, that was my home track for a long time, and I'm only an hour from there. But being offered the option of 2.5 hours away and leaving everything in PA, my home track became New Media Dragway. You know, that's it just out of convenience, and love the place. It's convenient to leave everything there, and we love the place. The kids started to race there. The Domino family does a great job. It's a whole weekend party. You know, it's very laid back and comfortable.
You can when you plan it, you go down the street to Knoebels, right?
Yes, of course, yes. See, you know.
Yeah, I have to say, Numidia is one of my favorite tracks. I really, now I haven't been there since the Domino family bought it. So, I mean, I guess that tells you how long it's been, because I bet you they've owned it at least a decade at this point in time.
You've talked highly of that track a couple times.
Yeah, Numidia is a really, really fun track to go to. And I have to say that when they used to have the Division One meet out there, it was a great track to go out to and watch, because the track is level itself. The pits are uphill, so by the time you get down to the finish line, mm-hmm. you're elevated probably a good 75 to 100 feet above the track. So everybody conglomerates down at the finish line, and the viewing angles are fantastic. It's just fantastic.
Yes. Absolutely. You're absolutely right. And they run a great program. The whole facility is nice. The bite is great. There's never a problem hooking.
Yeah. And I don't know if they do it anymore, but it was the only track that I ever know of that served pierogies and birch beer.
Yes.
Do they still have pierogies and birch beer there?
Yes, absolutely. He brings lemon ices from Brooklyn. He brings food, because he has a bus company in Brooklyn. He's back and forth from Brooklyn to Pennsylvania. He brings good food up there. He has the best food any track there is. And very accommodating to the races. Like I said, allowing you to keep your rigs at a place, it's a great thing. It really is.
Yeah, I got to get really down there.
And irony about the whole thing about Numidia is I won my first NHRA points race there in 93.
Oh, no kidding.
It's pretty funny how that's where I got my first win, and now that's where I'm racing all the time.
Yeah. I got to get down there. It's I know Rob Keister has run some Super Gas, Super Comp races out there. I don't know if I think he might be going back there this year.
Yes, I think he is.
Yeah, so we got to get back down there. It's a really great track to go to.
It is, absolutely.
So now we kind of covered yours and your dad's racing history. I guess I'd like to learn a little bit more about Biondo Racing Products. So when did where did Biondo Racing Products kind of come about?
My father had an idea. We need a practice tree. He was friends with Charlie Bacola, and Charlie Bacola is one of the smartest guys in the world, I would say. And they became close. They raced at National Speedway, and they talked about a practice tree, and Charlie developed one. It was just a five yellow tree on a piece of wood that sat on my father's desk, and it just had human reaction time on it. But you know when you hit the tree the same all the time, your human reaction time was the same. The number would be the same, whether it's 17 or 18.
Right.
It was a fictitious number, but it was a reaction time nevertheless, even before a lot of tracks had reaction times. So this was the ability to leave the same time all the time. So basically, they came out with this practice tree, and they developed a few and started to sell them and probably the mid-80s, and he couldn't make them fast enough. I mean, he had a full-time job at NAPCO Security, and he couldn't make these things fast enough for us, and they would sell like crazy. But, I mean, even another thing along the way, they came out with some other thing called the delay box, and they were, what if we leave off the bottom bulb? I can react off the bottom bulb in this fast car just with a couple of hundreds in it, and I won't be red. Well, that's great. Yeah, and they did that. They had a delay box. Then it came out, wow, what if we leave off the top bulb? I mean, this is way before anybody was even thought of this.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And the funny part about this story is, well, do they, amongst each other speaking, Charlie and my father, do we want to sell these to people, or do we want to just
keep it for
people.
Ourselves, right?
Well, and it was probably along the lines of, well, who's going to buy these? No one's going to buy this, They're a great, it's a great advantage, but we should probably just keep it to ourselves.
Yeah.
Let's keep it to ourselves. Well, that was definitely a multi-million-dollar mistake. when the patents started coming out from other companies that were simultaneously thinking and doing this also, yeah, that was an error. That was a mistake. You know, what are you going to do? You make some mistakes. But we sold delay boxes, practice trees, and, you know, manufactured them also, but couldn't manufacture in the speed that we could sell. So we got connected with manufacturers and gave people ideas and different type of delay box ideas and practice tree ideas and built in bulk. We didn't have the ability to manufacture. Peter and I, you know, we went to college for business. We weren't able to build the circuit boards, and we didn't know too much about any of the building or assembly, but we did have an idea of what the racers wanted and needed, and the ability to explain how things worked and the benefit of things, and I guess maybe so-called salesman type. You know, we knew what people wanted. We knew how to speak to people, treat customers, and it just kept growing bigger and bigger as we went through. I mean, I went to college and didn't expect to be doing this. Got a job with UPS right out of college and realized that, you know, Dad is, you know, at 5:02 p.m., he's home already, and he's done, and I'm coming home and lost probably 20 pounds in 2 weeks from delivering in the city in the middle of the summer. And he said, why don't you try help me out here. You can run some ads and try. Little by little, we grew. Worked out of one car garage, and we moved to a bigger place, and it kept escalating. And then, of course, Peter jumped on board with us too, with some good ideas and the ability to advertise and network with people. Being out at the racetrack all the time also helped. And it's I'm doing this probably 27 years now.
Wow. Yeah, I would say. I mean, there's just, again, so many questions that kind of come out of this, right? You know, I guess, you know, what I'll hit on just a little bit is the fact that I love dealing with you and Pete, because, like you said, you know how to treat people. You're trusted. You give people honest opinions. And, you know, it's just it's a family type atmosphere. Right. So, I mean, it's just been great to deal with over the years. I've been doing business with you for a long time. And it's just amazing how the business has grown since when I first basically started doing business with you guys until now.
Yeah. But,
you know, was there ever there had to be, I'm sure, at some point in time, the discussion among the three of you, hey, do we start becoming more of a catalog house like Jegs and Summit, right? And you guys have never done that. You've really kind of kept your specialty. Yeah, we're I want to say maybe the safety might have come third, but it was, yeah, practice trees and delay boxes. So you're kind of doing electronics, but then... Yeah,
the weather stations too was another big step. Yep. in right before the safety equipment. But, you know, as a lot of these companies' patents wore out and expired is a better word. Yep. There's a lot of people jumping on board to delay boxes and such. I mean, they're a tough thing to get right and work correctly. But as the patents wore off, we saw a need to probably get involved with someone else, and an Italian company comes to the track and looks for people and found some Italians, that's Sparco, that is, and wind up, you know, can you wear our stuff because get it out there for us? And we put their stuff on, and everyone was like, wow, these jackets are so thin. They're so nice. They're so comfortable. Well, maybe this is an opening for us. Maybe we should sell this stuff.
Yeah.
Because believing it and showing our friends and seeing how they liked it, wow, this stuff is great. This material is so soft, comfortable. This is probably the next step for us, getting into safety.
Right.
And so we did, and we work hand in hand with them on a lot of things. Peter spent some time out there telling them what they need to do to a jacket or what colors are popular, and trying to rework sizing to make it more relative to what the people in the United States are using and wearing. But the whole idea is this Europeans format, and people are starting to learn this, and I tell people every day, a couple times a day when they call, European sizing format that runs in numbers offers you double the amount of options you get from new American sizes.
Uh-huh.
Because you get like, you don't just have your large and extra large. You have large, large and a half, extra large and a half. You have double the amount of shoes from, which makes it really comfortable.
That's interesting.
You get something and it really fits right, that it runs in those half size increments.
And Sparco, Sparco had very little presence, it seemed like to me, in the U.S. prior to hooking up with Biondo. They didn't do anything in drag racing, did they?
You know what? They were just starting to get into it. And the thing is, when Sparco, everyone knew Sparco from the movies. seeing the gloves, the helmets, and I guess the seats in Fast and the Furious, you know, all the movies they've been involved with that the kids, because whenever I have a jacket and kids look at me at the track, say, oh, wow, that's a Sparko jacket, you know, yeah, the name is big. I can't say we're totally the reason for them being involved in drag racing. They came in fast, came in really hard with us and with the pros, and coming in as fast as they did with as good as a product as they have was really a big influence for them. A big success right there, because it was stuff that sold itself. Everyone wanted it when they saw it.
The Sparko line started out in the movies and found its way to drag racing.
Well,
it wasn't the other way
around. I don't think it started in the movies.
Okay.
I think it started in Indy cars and European.
Yeah.
But I think over here, a lot of the recognition is from the movies. Because I know if I even have a Sparko t-shirt or sweatshirt on, I notice it's the kids, the input. A lot of those guys know about Sparko. And I mean, even some of the video games my son plays, you know, you can see him. He's driving a car, and you can see the guy's wearing a Sparko glove, you know. And but, yeah, as far as the drag racing industry, I'm not going to say we made them famous. I don't know if we did, but I think we were definitely crucial in spreading the word.
Yeah, but you never, like I said, you never really looked to expand into, you know, let's call it normal performance parts, you know, cams and all the rest of that type of stuff that, you know,
well,
like a Jegs or Summit?
Right. Here's the thing. There's so much involved in getting bigger with, more space, more employees. The lack of knowledge we have in that, and the we'd probably have to learn it all. It's
true.
Tough to sell things you don't really know about. I mean,
yeah.
People called you with a part number. People called me for advice on a cam. I wouldn't even know where to start.
Yeah.
And we don't want to sell things we don't know about, and we can't really, I guess that we can't really describe well and sell. But on the other hand, if you think about having all of those items and growing bigger and having more employees, who is my competition? And am I ever going to be able to compete with them?
Right.
Price-wise and buy-ins, and it's way too much. We'd have to get way really big, and it would be out of control. And at the same time, investing all that time and money and effort, could I even succeed?
Right.
And we don't have to mention the names. You know, it's very simple.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you get in trouble for mentioning names on your show, but
no.
It's Jegs and Summit, right? I mean,
how would I
be able to compete with them?
Right.
So let me try to stay a little small and specialize in items. Everything under the roof, Peter, I, my father, my brother-in-law, we know all about everything, and we can just make the best with that and do the best we can with it.
And there's no doubt that, you know, you look at the, I'll just call them the mega line of boxes, right? I mean, nowadays, I mean, you guys probably came up with a new model, but it's like, you know, I don't know how many people, what percentage of the bracket racers out there run the Mega 450, but, you know, it's
a
very, very high percentage that of people that use that box. And, you know, it's a great product. And like I said, I mean, you guys know how to use it. I know darn well. You call the tech line and say you have a question. You guys can, you know, immediately walk guys through, you know, here's how you set things up. And they've just been super successful. I know you've taken a lot of feedback from racers over the years to make improvements. You know, it's every couple of years, I would say, that, you know, it wasn't too long ago the Mega 400 came out. So every few years you guys are coming out with a new box. And you've been really successful, you know, with those product lines that you have.
Yes, and we're successful with the delay boxes, and it's mainly because of Digital Delay. Digital Delay, they have great ideas, and we work together hand in hand with them for a long time, and it makes for a nice little fit.
Yeah, it's been a real good product line for you. And so, how many employees are you guys at now?
I have some off-premises employees, but I have it's pretty much five of us that are full time.
Okay.
Wow.
And my father's one of them. He's got a phone. He answers all the time, and he—it's you know, the phone rings a lot, and there's not many of us, so it's a lot of times, you know, juggling phones. But hey, it's a living. We do it, and we love it. We've been doing it a long time.
And we expect the kids to get into the business then when they're out of college.
I don't know. You know, it's kind of like the racing. They can race anytime they want. I don't want to force them into it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I feel about the business. I don't want to force my son into it. And, you know, Peter's son's a little younger than my son. But,
right.
You know, it's here, and would, if he wants, he can get into it, but I'm going to let him decide that on his own. He's going to be going to college next year, and I think he'll start figuring things out from there, hopefully.
Go ahead, Chris.
No, take it.
Well, I was just going to ask, so is there anything, I guess, that you know, that we really haven't covered about Beyondo Racing products in general that, you know, you really would like everybody to know? I mean, I've been dealing with you guys for a long time, so I know what I'm getting into, but, you know, I think there's a lot of people that probably don't, you know, especially a lot of local bracket racers that don't necessarily know, you know, what it is that Beyondo brings to the table and, you know, why they should call you guys.
Well, what we bring to the table is, obviously, when you call, if you don't order it online and you call and you get us, we're definitely able to steer you in the right direction no matter what it is you want, because we use it, we wear it, and if it doesn't fit, there's quick exchanges. We have great personalized customer service. We do this hands-on. I mean, stuff comes in, we get packages in, we immediately open them and read the notes, swap it out, and almost all the time, get it out the same day for a return. And so I guess a smaller company, we're like your local hardware store, not shopping at the Home Depot or the Lowe's. You're going to get a little better service, you know, but at the same time, we're able to supply the good prices also.
Yeah. I mean, your prices are extremely competitive. There's no doubt about it. And you know, when I think about the product lines themselves, you're talking about safety. So, I mean, seat belts. I just got my helmet. My helmet came in this morning.
Did your trailer come in yet?
No, that didn't. The trailer did not come in yet, but the helmet did come in. It's a really sharp helmet, that RGS carbon helmet. Yeah, I really liked it. I tried it on fit-wise. I'm definitely happy with it. So, I mean, you guys, you know, it's helmets, it's gloves, it's a Sparco line, jackets, pants. You have the electronics, so you got the delay boxes. You have the throttle stops themselves. So, I mean, you have the actual solenoid, throttle stops and solenoids. Do you guys have a plate stop as well?
Yes, we do. We sell number one stop. We're a distributor for a lot of different items, but a lot of the throttle stops we make on our own. The plate stop is pretty well perfected by Number One Stop, and we sell his products. Great stuff. Great customer service.
That's what I run on my car, right? Yeah, that's a good stop, no doubt. And then, like I said, you have the weather stations that you sell in addition to practice trees and
trans brake buttons, some specialty items there, a lot of shift solenoids and shifters.
And shifters,
and
too, yeah.
The Simpson line also we could throw in there. We're carrying those helmets, too, and, you know, we're carrying more and more of their stuff also year by year. And I think if we branch out, that's where we're going to branch out to. We want to, if you sell things to bracket races, there's a ton of bracket races. If you're selling things like items, products like throttle stops, you know, you're only going to get the NHRA crew and the racers there. So you got a lot less of a market. Yet a much bigger market is the bracket racer. And, you know, we want everyone to come to us for the safety and everything they can, and we'll give them the best deal and the best products and advice we can.
Awesome. Well, Sal, I appreciate you coming on and hanging out with us for a little while. It was insightful. And I know we got another focus episode coming up here in a couple of months as we talk a little bit more about the Fling series, the bracket series that you guys host.
Yep. Peter is a big part of that. I'm not as big a part as Peter and Kyle with that. Hey, someone has to man the business while he's gone trying to get this done. But it's the same philosophy of our business where, we're racers for a long time. We know what people want to buy. We know what people need. We know what they want to hear. And when they want to purchase something, we know the advice they need. And now if we're running a race, we know what people want to come for. They want prizes. They want, you know, nice, attractive money purses and customer service. Once again, I don't know if there's a so-called circuit out there that has the customer service that the Spring Fling brand can bring with it.
Yeah, it's a great race series for sure. You know, I haven't competed in any of the races yet, but every time I'm watching online, I'm sitting there thinking to myself, why am I not there right now? It's just a fantastic. It really is just a fantastic series.
It really is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Well, Sal, again, I appreciate you making some time for us, and it was a good talk, man. Thank you for coming on.
Yeah, anytime. Thanks for having me. Thank you.
We'll definitely do it again. Thanks again.
Okay, you're welcome.
Thanks, Sal.
Take care.
You're
welcome.
There goes Sal Biondo with Biondo Racing Products. Great talk. I'm bummed out that we dropped him there, but I'm glad we were able to recover and grab him back. And it was a good talk. Turn our attention quick to Empire. Empire going to make another go at it this weekend. Going to try anyway, right?
Going to try. I know when I was coming up here, I got a severe thunderstorm alert coming across my phone as I was driving up here. Yeah, I'm not sure what the weather looks like at the moment. I know it's not going to be supposed to not be as nice as it was the past few days. Right. But, yeah, hopefully the weather will hold out and we'll be able to get some racing. And like I said, Lancaster, I know Friday night they have this new class that they're trying, their 495 series. No delay boxes or throttle stops. You can run nitrous, so I mean that it's going to be basically, let's call it the same thing as you know, very similar to the 470 guys, and then Saturday out at Empire is the 470 guys. So yeah, there's some good racing going on this weekend. Hopefully the weather will hold out.
And again, just to reiterate some of the news that's already kind of circulated around the community, posting on their webpage, Spencer's Dragway, that they are taking a year hiatus at this point, and there's at this point, the way that the message read was they're not going to race this year, and if anything changes, they'll let you know as needed. And it's happened a couple times before, but anytime I see the temporary hiatus signs coming up around a racetrack, you get a little bit nervous about what's going to happen there, especially these days, you know, these times. If it was a standalone track and it didn't have the oval track tied to it, which is still active, it'd be even more concerning, but hopefully they can get everything together and get a program put together for 2018.
Yeah, what's really concerning about, you know, them and Lancaster both is their proximity to the residential areas. Mm-hmm. So yeah, for some place like Spencer, you got to wonder, okay, how long is it before, you know, somebody says, hey, you know what, this property is just too valuable to be doing what we're doing with it, and we're going to doze it over and we're going to make it into housing development. And, right. You know, the track is very, very close to, let's call it Webster. So the suburb of Webster, which is where Xerox headquarters, well, I guess that's not true. It's where Xerox headquarters used to be, but, right. but a very large Xerox campus is right now still. And you know, the village of Webster is fairly big, and you know, people continue with the suburban sprawl, right?
And it's in Williamson, which is right on 104.
Right. Exactly. So, I mean, and who knows? Maybe it's commercial property that's turned into a retail, or who knows? But so that's definitely a concern. When, like I said, when you hear about people taking hiatuses like that, mm-hmm. I got my fingers crossed that somebody will step up and say, hey, you know what? I want to lease this track or buy it or do something with it, because yeah, I'd be ashamed to see that that track close for good.
Lease it.
Me?
Yeah.
Yeah. I got enough things to do already. I don't need to own a track, too, or lease a track.
You shouldn't. It doesn't mean you can't.
That's right. That's right.
People make bad decisions every day.
Okay. Well, I'm not going to be one of them.
Not true. You have how many Mud Boss cars?
Oh, yes. And I've made plenty of bad decisions, trust me.
good talk. I mean, Sam Biondo, I'm looking forward to having him him on again and having Pete on again at some point too, talk a little bit about that bracket series. That was a good talk. That's gonna pretty much wrap it up for number 14's in the books, our first episode here from the new studios. That's gonna do it for us here in the North Park building, right off of Cuga Street at Academy Square. We appreciate everybody listening in and hanging out with us for a little while. We're gonna be back again in 2 weeks with more talk about drag racing in New York and all points beyond. Thanks for watching. We'll see you next time.
This has been the Final Round Drag Racing Podcast, coming to you live from the FingerLakes1.com studios in downtown Seneca Falls, New York. We'll see you right back here again in 2 weeks. Thanks for watching.